Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm film critic April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, producer, and we talk in depth about their fave genre film, or maybe one that influenced their own work. Today, I'm so very happy to welcome actor, writer, director Lynn Shelton to the show. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, April. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for coming. For those unfamiliar with Lynn Shelton's work, let me give you a quick introduction. Lynn has directed 7 feature films, including Hump Day, Touchy Feely, Your Sister's Sister, and Laggies. Her work is screened at the Toronto International Film Festival, Sundance, Cannes Directors Fortnight, Slam Dance, South by Southwest, and Deauville. She's picked up a whole bunch of awards, including 2 from the Independent Spirit Awards, the Acura Someone to Watch Award, and the John Cassavetes Award. And Lynn also directed a lot of television recently. You can see her work on Mad Men, Master of None, Casual, Love, Santa Clarita Diet, The Mindy Project, New Girl, Shameless, Marin, Fresh Off the Boat, and Glow. Now she's releasing her newest feature. It's called Outside In, which stars Jay Duplass as a man just getting out of prison after serving 20 years on some trumped-up charges when he was a teenager. And Jay's character tries to transition back to normal life, but he also develops romantic feelings for his former teacher, played by Edie Falco, who had offered him encouragement throughout his imprisonment. So it is a drama that actually, I think when I watched the movie that you selected, had some things in common. So I was happy that you selected it. Lynn's selection for today is Code 46. Can you tell me why that's one of your faves?
Oh, my God. First of all, I want to thank you for the opportunity to choose a film to talk about today because it afforded me the opportunity to rewatch this film, which has been on my, you know, perennial list of top 10, top 5 favorite films of all time.
Oh, okay.
For quite some time. But it's been a while since I've seen it. And it was incredible to watch it again this week and just be like, this film is insanely good. Yes, I was correct. It is still one of my favorite films of all time. And everyone must see it. I've decided to just to sort of take a part-time job to just proselytize that people to see this film because nobody has. Nobody has seen this film. I literally cannot remember who told me to watch it, but somebody told me you have to see this film. And I saw it like years ago and I saw it and it would just blew my mind. And I cannot remember who it is because each person that I've been texting, like while I was rewatching, was like, oh, my God, this is so incredible. I forgot how incredible it is. It's still incredible. I think it's Amanda Morin's best performance. And that's saying a lot because she's incredible. She's a goddess. But and all the people I was texting, I sort of had assumed had all seen it. And they were like, oh, I'll have to see that movie. I haven't even heard of that movie. And I'm just like, what are you? Please now go see it. I can't stop talking about it. So, yeah, I don't know, man. This movie, it's like it got buried. Did you know of it before?
No.
Yeah, right?
And I've seen a lot of Michael Winterbottom's movies,
yeah.
And I had not seen this.
This is like my favorite Michael Winterbottom movie, and I love his work. Love, love, love. The chemistry between Tim Robbins and Samantha Martin, who are about 4 feet apart in height difference, yeah, which is really funny, is incredible. But there, I mean, there's just, oh my God, I can't wait to just dive in because there's so many incredible things about this movie. I think it is one of the most, maybe the most romantic film I've ever seen.
Aww.
And the most tragic film. I don't know. I love it so much. And the music and, I mean,
okay.
Good Lord.
Before
yeah.
we go too far in it, I want to say, for those of you who haven't seen Code 46, which is maybe a lot of you guys, maybe.
Probably.
I don't know. We'll see.
I think so.
Today's episode will give you some spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. My motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to pause and peep Code 46 right now, do it. And if you're back, then you're listening and maybe you've seen it. Okay, so I'm going to give you a quick summary of what this movie is about so we can just kind of jump into everything. Written by Frank Cottrell Boyce and directed by Michael Winterbottom in 2003, the film stars Tim Robbins and Samantha Morton as 2 star-crossed lovers kept apart by society and circumstances. In a near future, humans have experimented with cloning and genetic manipulation to the point where the government lightly monitors people's relationships to make sure that couples do not share the same genetic code. Robbins plays a kind of detective. He's dispatched to Shanghai to investigate a printing plant that makes papels, which are essentially travel documents or cover that allow a human to move freely in the world for a certain allotted amount of time. You see, someone's been making forgeries, and Robbins needs to find out who it is. And he'll use his special, quote-unquote, empathy virus to detect who. The virus allows him to read people if he can learn a personal detail about them. And at the factory, he quickly figures out that it's actually Samantha Morton's character. That's not too much of a spoiler because it happens very quickly. And she's been smuggling out papels to give to people who want to use them to see the world, to see people, or to study somewhere else. But he doesn't give up the culprit. Instead, he spends the night with her and falls in love. And when she becomes pregnant, he realizes the government has taken her away, aborted the fetus, and erased him from her memory because they share a genetic code. Still, he's in love with her, and they try to make it work. But when your government possesses the power to infect you with viruses and erase your memory, it is an uphill, short-lived battle. So, ooh, okay. It was a really fascinating film to watch for the first time. I'm really happy that you suggested it. One of the things that Michael Winterbottom had, you know, said about this film, he said he called the premise, quote, a banal idea of a love affair where you meet someone and external forces tear you apart and then you have to live with that. But he felt it would be this combination of honesty in the performance and this light sci-fi element of the near future that would sell the film. And so he's touching on something that's been said a lot, that we're all essentially telling the same stories over and over and over again in different ways. And, you know, for you, what is it about the sci-fi element in Code 46 that elevates or differentiates the story from the other love stories? Is it elevated or different, you know, or you? I'm curious about what this means to you.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I've been thinking a lot about, I mean, like the way I just framed it as being one of the most romantic movies I've ever seen and one of the most tragic movies I've ever seen, like the best tragedy, the best romance, you know. Mm-hmm. I say that before I say sci-fi.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Because it really is, it transcends the genre in that way. Not that, I mean, I love sci-fi movies, but it that's not kind of the point of it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the plot rests on these sci-fi elements that, you know, it wouldn't work without the science fiction.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet it's not the heart of it, you know. So it's like it really has this like incredibly lyrical, cinematically poetic, and just humanistic heart. Like it really is. It's just sort of this very, you know, it's very emotional.
Yes.
And that's where the heart of the thing lies. The sci-fi element, one of the things I love about the way the science fiction aspect of it is how he handles it. I don't know if there's any CGI in this movie. It's, you know, so it's not like anything, the island or whatever, you know, any movie that comes to mind that's science fiction, you think of science fiction elements a lot. I mean, CGI elements, you just think about blue screen and, you know, and just like Blade Runner. I mean, anything.
Yeah.
And this models whatever, you know, it is, whatever the technology was of the day. And this movie is so elegantly, it portrays this quote unquote near future, but not that near. It's not like 5 years away. It's like it feels like it could be, you know, at least 50 years away or something, you know, or more. But he does it all through location, through juxtaposing landscapes, telling you you're on your way to Shanghai and it looks like a desert. You know, it's like these strange, beautiful landscapes. This sort of surreal use. And then the actual architectural, when you're in a building, you know, he just kind of films things in a way that seems likely to, that would exist, you know, in the future. It doesn't, you know, a little Logan's Runny in that way, like just kind of choosing these locations and the way he shoots them. And then just little elements that they barely even touch on. I mean, they have maybe a line or two about it, but like they're, everything happens at night. They all go to work at night. The night starts when the sun comes up. Because the sun is toxic. So you see, whenever it's daytime and you're outside in the city, not El Fuero, but in the city, you see everything's abandoned. Nobody's outside because the sun is so toxic. So when they're running through the exterior courtyard, you see them hiding from the sun underneath jackets, you know, and running to get across the square because it's supposed to be bad for you. The people who live on the outside, of the civilized world, you know, they have to, they just, at the end, you see her tragically sort of wandering the desert, and she's just, she's not doing that anymore. Like, nobody hides from the sun because they can't really afford it, I guess. But,
yeah,
you know, which is interesting. And then this whole concept of the viruses and language. He uses language in this very, just again, extremely subtle.
Yeah, let's talk about the language in this.
Yeah. So what he does is he just sort of mixes in without any acknowledgement at all. It's mostly English, but then there are just these little words from other languages thrown in, and you have to kind of piece it together, you know. And that's one of the things I love about I really love a film that doesn't take the audience, just like spoon feed them, this is this world and
yes,
this, and spell it all out, like giving you little breadcrumbs of mystery. You know, you don't want to make it so opaque that it pushes people away.
Yeah.
But as a filmmaker, I love to just sort of give people little breadcrumbs. And so it sort of piques their interest and it engages them and makes them active participants in the experience of watching the film. So they're kind of going, oh, well, that's curious. What did he just say? What did she just, what was that mean? What could that mean? And it may sound vaguely familiar. I think they use salam as a greeting. Mm-hmm. And then there's little French words and little Spanish words and little, you know.
Yeah, I hear like a little bit of Korean and Japanese in there as well.
Tell me what you're doing later tonight.
Is that a question or an invitation?
It's a prompt.
Tonight, I am going to stay awake till the sun goes down. I'm not going to sleep.
Pourquoi?
It's my birthday.
Happy birthday.
This nod to the fact that the world has become very global, you know.
Yes, exactly. And I think that they introduced the sun thing the same way, you know, because Samantha Morton's character, it's her birthday, and she says that she's going to
stay up all night
until the sun
goes down.
Goes down.
Yeah.
And I was like, it took me a second. Do you rewind things?
Right.
I backed it up.
Right.
Sorry. I wasn't watching it on a VHS just in case people were wondering.
Yeah, right.
Although I do have a VHS player.
Yes.
So the sun, and then of course she asks him, you know, like, do you really think the sun is toxic
right,
as they say?
And
you
that's
know?
It.
Yeah, and they don't go into it for very long. Like, they're not having this long discussion about whether or not the sun is toxic. You just understand that there's a reason that they're outside at night.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so cool. And they're all, and the work day, you know, quote unquote day, is it not, like, basically day has now become when the sun is down. But the language of it has just, you know, switched over. So I really admire the resourcefulness and the cleverness of how he really creates a world, the world building that he does through you know, without special effects.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the most special effect-y is probably, I know they built, they, I think they shot in Dubai and Shanghai and in India, maybe Mumbai. And then they did all their interiors in London. And I know they built, I remember reading or hearing something about how they built her apartment. And it does feel like, that doesn't feel like an apartment, that like the house he lives in with his wife because he's married and he's a kid.
Yeah, it's supposedly like, in Seattle too.
Right, so. It's supposedly in Seattle. Yeah, and you never see out the windows and it just kind of looks like they could have found a location, you know.
Yeah.
But her apartment feels different and weird and smaller and like it's and very sort of specific to the future. Like there's a glass wall and it just seemed, and I think they did build that. I think feel like that was one of the few built sets. And she wakes up and there's a little touchpad, you know, kind of a screen that she touches, touch screen on this. That's like the most kind of artificial, I guess, like non, the one element in the whole film to me that felt like, oh, they actually didn't use a pre-existing location.
Yeah.
You know?
And that's the whole thing. I think, you know, in his interviews, Winterbottom was saying that they didn't think that much would actually change in the future outside of how people communicate with one another. And that's essentially, you know, like this, you know, technology of the home and how people communicate through phones or, how they, you know, like those are the, and remember, this is 2003 too.
Yeah,
this
exactly.
Probably filmed in 2001, 2002.
Right, exactly.
Very different
time. There were two things that struck me as being prescient, and I guess one of them wasn't really that Prussian. But he, at the very beginning, he's in a hotel room by himself and he's boxing and he has goggles on, VR goggles.
Yes.
And he's boxing with an actual boxer and you can see that. And that's like, okay, well, that's now. That's totally happening.
That's exactly
right
now.
Yeah. And then the other thing that was really now, and this is so, this sounds so goofy, but I'm in love with this. I've literally had this on my phone for 2 weeks. And I love it. This dumb app called Marco Polo. Have you heard of this thing?
I have heard of it. I have not used it.
I love it so much. It makes me feel so giddy and goofy. And it's just that you're looking. It's like texting, but it's video. So you turn it on and there you are. And you just pick the person you want to talk to. And you're like, hey, how's it going? Blah, 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 whatever. And there's this one moment in and then you send it, you know, and there's this one moment in the film where he's actually, it's like her outgoing message.
Yes.
And but it looks exactly like Marco Polo. He's looking at his phone. There she is saying, hi, I'm not here right now. You know, leave me a message. And it's like, oh, my God, it's Marco Polo. It was just very funny. And that was a while ago. That was, you know, that was.
These are things that seem plausible, too. These are realistic future things mm-hmm. where, like, this will be a problem with genetic modification of human beings, of cloning, of, you know, that kind of stuff. And I think about this in terms of a lot of films that are doing that kind of light sci-fi futuristic mm-hmm. thing. Even in Logan, you've got, you know, just mm-hmm. a little bit of a difference in the way that, you know, like there are driverless trucks and those things. And,
right.
But most
right.
everything is kind of the same.
Familiar. Yeah.
And you see that a lot Into the Forest, Patricia Rosema's movie as well, did a little bit of that. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, you know, for your film, you don't have a sci-fi element, but you do have this character who's been away from the world for 20 years.
Yes.
And I was thinking about that in terms of where you're shooting, because you're shooting in a smaller town of Oregon mm-hmm. where things actually
Washington.
Don't. Washington. Oh, yeah. Sorry, Washington. Okay. Pacific Northwest.
It's all the same.
We'll get less, less specific. Where things might not change that much.
Right.
And I was wondering how you decide what a character who's kind of fish out or watery mm-hmm. for 20 years is going to look, you know, you're going to just be like, oh, cell phones. Oh, my God. You know, how much do you want to spend
right.
time on that?
Yeah. Well, and you know, not a lot. I mean, you really can go anywhere in the world and see people staring at their phones. But honestly, in Granite Falls, it wasn't something that I saw as much as I do in L.A. or Seattle, even, you know, mm-hmm. where people are just glued to, you know, standing at a street corner, just staring at their phones. And yet everybody has a phone and everybody has a smartphone and everybody at some point or other is looking down at it, you know, when you're actually there physically in that particular little hamlet, which is a very small town mm-hmm. in the foothills of the Cascade Mountains. It's like an hour and a half away up north and east of Seattle. But, you know, we did a lot of research into what it's like to have to reenter into the world after getting out of prison for being in that long. And, of course, just the sort of emotional, mental, you know, trauma of it, the kind of resonance of how what that transition is like. But right now in particular, there has been so much that's happened technologically, so much of a shift that there's a lot to take in. And, you know, you're aware of it to a certain degree, but there's mm-hmm. and varying and different prisons will have allow different amounts of access
yeah.
to the world and to computers and so on. But, you know, he basically had access to like a word processor. They, you know, he took some sort of job skill course where he was able to like create a basic resume. But that's about it. Like he didn't really have access to the internet. He certainly didn't have access to a cell phone. So trying to get used to, you know, people just saying, just, you know, like, oh, I'll text you, you know, yeah, let's get together. I'll text you. And he's like, I don't even know if the phone the flip phone that can do that. He has no idea, you know. And it's just like everybody seemed to him, it just seems like this level of obsession with the technology that, you know, he just wasn't.
And he's riding
for.
A bike like he's riding like yeah. an like a
kid's
a
bike.
Kid's
a fix
bike.
It. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Which is, you know, this is the story is that this guy got shoved into jail. Prison is very different than jail. Prison at the age of 18, right out of high school, and really not f- for good reason. Like, he basically gets put away for a crime that he didn't commit. He was there at the wrong time when his idiot friend pulled out a gun and you know, mm-hmm. did this thing. And then he's the only one who stayed behind and tried to help the guy. And everybody else ran away. He never narked on his friends, but he got put away as if he pulled the trigger, which is an actual thing. It's called felony murder. And if you're there when a trigger gets pulled, you can be put away as if you'd pulled it. And there, because of mandatory minimum sentences, he really was put away for even longer. And then this Edie Falco's character not only helped him kind of mentally survive while he was in prison by just letter writing and, you know, basically being his friend and becoming mm-hmm. a deeper, deeper friendship, but also then ends up becoming instrumental in getting him out. But when he gets out, you know, so when he goes away, he goes into prison, this completely terrifying, you know, alternate universe where he couldn't fully develop yeah. as an adult. You can't really grow up in a normal way. You know, obviously he has to grow up in some ways and in some ways that most people never have to grow up, you know, quote unquote, grow up. He had to adapt, but he never really got to fully develop as a normal sort of human being. And so in a lot of ways, when he gets out of prison, he just reverts to being 18 again because his emotional social development has just sort of stopped there.
Yeah.
You know, it got like just, you know, took a little pause. And so there's something so poignant to me about this image of him riding around town in the same bike that he used to love when he was in high school.
Yeah.
And he also bonds with another kid, an 18-year-old, who's Edie Falco's daughter, Caitlin Dever, the incredible Caitlin Dever, because he really actually has a lot in common with her on that sort of emotional, social level. And she's kind of who he should have been hanging out with when he was 18, you know, and would have been hanging out with. And, you know, and she is mature and precocious and relates to him. So they have this genuine bond as well. That's very interesting, you know.
And you co-wrote this with Jay Duplass after you had kind of come up with this idea mm-hmm. and that you wanted to work with him. I'm curious about this in terms of, you know, getting actors involved at what stage, because mm-hmm. I know from like this movie Code 46 that Samantha Morton was involved first mm-hmm. and then they were like, okay, we've got to find someone
yeah.
who's going to be a good match for her, and it took right. them a while, right?
It took them a while, yeah.
Which, I mean, a romance, if you don't find the right casting or chemistry,
yeah.
it's gonna sink. I've seen them.
Yeah,
they're
man.
Terrible. It's the worst thing.
And there's it's really hard to know really if it's gonna work, you know, because even if you all get in a room together and do a chemistry read, you know, quote unquote, or some sort of screen test, it's, you know, that's just one, you know, they may grow over the course of the days and weeks of the shoot to just hate each other. I mean, you just don't really know, right?
I mean, God, but, you hope not to, like, hate each other.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. Well, you hear about, you know, there are those legendary, you know, there are films where you hear about that happening. And, you know, luckily, the experience I've had working with people in general has been, I mean, when I think about Your Sister's Sister, where Rosemary DeWitt and Emily Blunt met 24 hours or something before they had to have scenes together as, you know, having a lifelong friendship as sisters and, or, you know, a lifelong relationship as sisters. And we put them in this house. So they were living together in this really nice, nice house.
Mm-hmm.
And they just like stayed up all night talking. Like they just came to each other with open hearts and they just bonded.
So you didn't have to like, you know, facilitate anything for them to.
No. And I always make. Other than just making sure to put them together and give them a lot of like cozy pillows and like, you know, here's yeah. a bottle of wine, like go at it, you know, really. I mean, I remember when, because a lot of times I've never worked on a movie where I have weeks or months or really any time at all to actually, you know, on set beforehand to actually, you know, get them, you know, hang out and rehearse even or whatever. So I remember Laggy's same thing. You know, Kira was already, I think, in town, and then Chloe Moretz showed up, and they were supposed to be really good friends in mm-hmm. the film. And I took them out for dinner. We had this sort of, the three of us had this like 4-hour dinner, but it really was just so they could get, you just want to be in each other's physical presence. And what I noticed, and it was the same when Sam Rockwell showed up, is that these actors, you have to just have this very open, you know, very open attitude, you know, open hearted. You mm-hmm. really have to come at each other just like with open arms. And it's an extremely vulnerable place to be in, you know. And that's why they're such great actors, too, because they're able to be, you know, that sort of there's a lot of permeability in their boundaries, you know. And so they're sharing with the audience all of their, you know, what's going on in their head. We can see it in their eyes. Mm-hmm. I mean, Edie Falco is a great example of that. Luckily, with Edie and Jay, they had met before. But she was she was the last piece of our, you know, the crowning jewel, basically, yeah. of our cast. Caitlin Dever, I had worked with on Laggies and knew I wanted to work with her. So she was on board, like, as soon as I got Jay on board, basically. Like, I knew that she had to be in the film. But Edie was that role of Carol was the last one to kind of, like, come and fit into place. And she, they had met on Landline, Gillian Robespierre's movie.
Yeah.
And then, but
where
had
she
only
plays
spent
her daughter's
husband.
Yeah.
yeah. And they only were on, I guess they weren't really on set that long together. They had a couple scenes and they were, you know, it was a couple days on set, but they really got along, you know, and hit it off and had a good time hanging out. So there was that warmth that had already been established, which is just so helpful. And in many of the films that I've created and originated myself, I start with an actor. Like, I really, like Hump Day is a great example. I met Mark and I saw him act while I was
Mark Duplass, just
sorry, Mark okay. Duplass, who's Jay Duplass's brother, who I've worked with a couple of times. He's been in two of my films. He acted in A Hump Day and in Your Sister's Sister. And in the case of Hump Day, I knew I wanted to work with him. And I've done this now many times with other actors, but he was the first one I really did it with where I was like, okay, who could he be? Who could he play? What kind of character would I want to see him play? What do you think? What do I think he would be interested in playing? You know, and then putting him in different scenarios in my head. And then I pitched him a very basic premise. And then over the course of the next few months, we cast around him. He said yes. We cast around him and then kept developing the treatment of the movie. And all the dialogue ended up being improvised. And what is nice about bringing actors in that early is that I like to know who the characters are as I'm, you know, or before I'm figuring out how they're going to behave in a scene, you know, because I want them, you know, I have to know who they are so I can make sure that they're behaving believably,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
Now, you can go back and forth a little bit, too, and say, you know, I really want this thing to happen in the plot. How can we backload into that by, you know, what kind of backstory can we give the relationship between these two people or the character, you know, backstory to make this thing happen, you know? And I remember there was when we were developing, I was developing the what was going to happen in Hump Day, which was very, very closely structured, even though I didn't want to write any dialogue. I wanted them.
yeah.
I wanted that because I wanted it to be very, very naturalistic. And I knew that both Josh Leonard and Mark would be able to improvise dialogue beautifully as well. They did. But there was this sort of hole in the script because I didn't have the wife, the character of Mark's character's wife cast yet. And I needed her because I needed her to be cast before I could really figure out who she was, you know. And so I cast Alicia Del Moore, and then we were able to sort of figure out, okay, who is this person? Because even though she's not going to get as much screen time, I really didn't want her to feel like the proverbial two-dimensional girlfriend / wife / whatever, you know. I didn't just want her to be some sort of just a device, you know, for the for the guys.
Yeah.
So I'm probably as proud of her character as I am of anybody else because she's so any other aspect of that film because she is so three-dimensional. But anyway, so yeah, it's a way that I really like to work. I haven't been able to work that way every time, but this was an example. Outside In, my new movie, is one of those examples where I'd known Mark. I'd known Jay Duplass through his brother in filmmaking circles. Like, we hung out at film festivals and stuff. And I remember the first time I met him coming up to me, this big smile, huge hug, and just like, oh my God, you're just this radiant soul. Like, he's just such a sweet souled human being. And I loved him immediately and felt always very sort of like bonded to him as a filmmaker and, you know, and I don't know, I just really adored him. And then saw him act. I remember the first time I saw him act in Transparent on Amazon and just, I was blown away by his acting. And then immediately told him, I'm going to lightly stalk you until I figure out a role to pitch to you because we have to work together. I have to direct you as an actor. And he was like, great, you know. And it was, I felt like it was at least a couple of years later before I was able to come up with this scenario, which I pitched to him, and he immediately was so engaged and so interested and immediately said, could me and my brother produce it? And I was like, great, I don't have a producer, and I know you guys actually get things done, you know. So he was always involved from the beginning as I was developing the script for a while on my own, and then became so impassioned and so engaged that he just ended up becoming a co-writer as well, which was great, because I feel like the two of us really brought, you know, I don't know, it really was a good thing.
Well, we're gonna take a quick break, and then we're gonna get back into making those partnerships where you're writing something together with someone and what happens in that kind of magic space. All right, we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Allie Gertz.
And I'm Julia Prescott, and we're the host of Everything's Coming Up Simpsons. We are a Simpsons podcast brand new to the Maximum Fun Network, and every episode we cover a different episode of The Simpsons that is a favorite of our special guests.
We've had guests that are showrunners and writers and voice actors like Nancy Cartwright, all people that have worked on The Simpsons, and we've also had guests like Weird Al and people that are on the Max Fun Network already, and each week we will talk to a very cool guest about their favorite episode, and it is so much fun. So if you like The Simpsons, come listen to Everything's Coming Up Simpsons.
All right. Smell you later.
Welcome back. You're listening to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm here speaking today with Lynn Shelton about the movie Code 46. The writing of this is kind of fascinating to me, because Winterbottom had like come up with the story while he was working on 24-Hour Party People.
Right.
And he had wrangled Frank in and was like, okay, yes, we need to write this now, which to me seems also a little bit insane, where you're trying to focus all that you can on one movie, and then you immediately go into a different one the second that that one is done, finished, you know. And those two movies, you know, I guess that there's some kind of coherence, thematic coherence, just because of everything that Winterbottom does, but they also seem very different.
Very different. Stylistically, you know? What he was trying to do, I feel like, in terms formally, they're really different. And subject matter, like really everything about them is really different.
I mean, you've got like one that's kind of like a comic biography. And then one
that uses really revolutionary. I love that movie, 24-Hour Party People, and the way that there's direct address, and he goes in, he sort of slips in and out of, and you could almost call it almost a docudrama, you know,
because
he's reenacting real things that took place.
Yes.
But the way that he folds it into, and it's so fun, the way he sort of, you know, uses Coogan in a very, you know, and his humor, his brand of humor, and then the direct address thing is just his transitions. Another like mind blowing film from that director for sure.
But it's interesting to me. I mean, when you're working on something, do you ever feel the need to do something the exact opposite on the next one?
Well, usually, I mean, when I started making films, I was just a one project at a time gal for sure. I could only focus on one thing, and then once I was, you know, through the writing of it, and then the production of it, and then the editing of it, usually at the very end of the editing process, I would start to think about the next project.
Yeah.
But it was really like one thing at a time. And then my third film, Hump Day, got into Sundance, and that sort of changed everything, because I had that just changes things, especially if you get into like dramatic competition.
Yes.
And all of a sudden I've made all seven of my films in Washington State. I live in Seattle and based up there. And I had these, you know, reps, agents and managers in L.A., you know, saying, hey, we want to represent you. And I was like, I don't know what that looks like. Is that something I even want to do? I mean, I really kind of have it pretty good up here. I just like I part time teach, and then I steal all the equipment, not steal, borrow all the equipment from the cage, the school cage, on summer breaks, and take my favorite students out with me and make a movie. Like, that seems like it's working pretty good, you know. But then I thought, well, but maybe I could make movie money doing, you know, television shows, and maybe, you know. And then they started sending me all these projects. And as time has gone by, I've come to be that person that you're supposed to be, the, you know, working the way most people do in Hollywood, which is that I've got all these different things all these pots on the stove kind of boiling at various levels, you mm-hmm. know, in their cooking process at the same time. It took a really long time to get there. To be comfortable with having different things in development at the same time. And I'm still not totally comfortable with it. But I do find that occasionally it's really nice to have a couple of projects to be bouncing back and forth between, because your brain, you kind of get a little bit stumped, or, you know, you get a little bit of a block on one.
Yeah.
And you can just kind of put it on the shelf for a second and go turn your attention towards something else. And it actually, I'm like, oh, I can kind of see the advantage of this. Or even if it's like you're editing one thing and writing another thing, or, you know.
I want to jump to ways of shooting, because I know that with this kind of small crew that Winterbottom had, that he would just drive up to a spot. I think, like, the interviews that Tim Robbins were giving were just hilarious, because he was, like, very unsure of how it was going. You know, like, they would drive up to a spot and be shooting outside with a small crew, and he'd be like, oh, we're going now?
Yeah.
Great. Okay. And then Samantha Morton, I love her interviews, because she's like, yes, I live for this. I feed off of this. And
I know she said this great thing about how I'm not really a great actor, but I'm a, you know, pretty fantastic reactor.
Oh God, she's
so
funny.
Just beautiful?
I love her. Yeah.
I know, she's so heavy. She's so great. She's just talking about how, you know, and he just throws us into this environment and says, react off of the world around you. And I mean, you see her do it. Like, her face and her, like, how she's taking in the world and how her character, I cannot say enough about this woman. And the way that when the camera is on her, she just sort of, there's this lack of self-consciousness that I've never seen in the likes of what, you know, of this in any other actor face. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of, believe me, I mean, I'm in love with a lot of different actors and the way that they perform, but there's just something so specific and unique about Samantha, especially in this, like, phase. She had this incredible phase, and I just had recently seen Jesus a Son Again, which is just holy
moly. I was just thinking that, man. And Morvan Collar, too.
And Morvan Collar. And even her performance in Sweet and Low Down. I remember I saw those two things.
Oh, my God, yes. I had that on VHS. I loved that.
Oh, my God. And the contrast between her character in Jesus a Son and Morvan and Sweet and Low Down is just like, you are amazing. Like, I don't even think I realized it was the same actor, because she was so different.
Yeah.
And, you know, just that range. But it's the way that she, I mean, even Minority Report, like, just the way that she kind of, you know, just, she's like, has no boundaries between of self. Like, there's something that she just gives completely to the camera. And then in this movie, he often asks her, or maybe it's not often, maybe it was only one scene, but I feel like there are these moments where she looks directly into your eyes, because she's looking right into the lens, which is not something that is done a lot in film. And it's
like
so
Jonathan Demme
intimate.
And that's it.
Yeah, exactly. It's just so crazy intimate. And one of the, I think it's maybe in that sex scene, one of the sex scenes, but she's slightly out of focus, and she's just looking straight into your eyes. And I mean, you're just like, I was weeping. I'm just so moved.
We're going to take another quick little break, and we'll be right back to discuss some other things with having maybe celebrities on set.
Either way, we're now on the Max Fun Network, and I would like it if you checked it out. It's a lot less professional than what you're hearing right now.
speaking of not as professional,
it's a minute.
I just hit record just 20 seconds ago.
Oh.
So we got the end of that. So just give us the head again.
Say? All right. Hey, my name's Jonah Ray.
The music won't sing
that. No, it doesn't matter, Neil. My name's Jonah Ray. I have a podcast called Jonah Radio with my friends Cash.
Oh, you gave your credits at the top.
No, it wasn't recorded. That's exactly what he just said.
No, but we got to do it. Now you got to do your credits. Where do people know you from?
Forget it. Listen to Jonah Radio on maxfun.org.
And welcome back. You're listening to Switchblade Sisters. This is April Wolf speaking to Lynn Shelton about Code 46. Yes, in case people were wondering, in Code 46, that really was Mick Jones singing Should We Stay or Should We Go in the karaoke bar scene. I love that Winterbottom was like, let's just call him up and see if he can come down. And then he just sings it for seven times.
My buddy.
And he's like, that's amazing. At the same time, I'm like, maybe it would be weird to have a celebrity kind of encroach on the, like a different kind of celebrity, you know, encroach upon a scene. You know, like, does that break things up? Mm-hmm. You've been working at a bunch of TV stuff. And I always wonder, you know, because there are a lot of cameos. Have you shot something where there's like a big cameo of someone in a TV show?
I know. There's definitely been stunt casting, but, you know, the one that leaps to mind is shooting an episode of, it's not like Brad Pitt, right? But like one of, like, this is sort of a typical one of like Rob Riggle, you know, let's just call up Rob and see if he'd be this, you know, like really small role, you know, on in Fresh Off the Boat. You know, it's mostly like that. But I'm trying to think if there's been any huge, I mean, honestly, it was the cast itself. You know, the very first TV job I ever did was Mad Men, which is
crazy
town.
Which season was that?
Crazy. It was season 4, episode 10, Hands and Knees. I really lucked out, too, because it was one of the best scripts ever. But that was my favorite show at the time that I got hired. And I mean, I was kind of obsessed with the show. So, you know, working with John Hamm was probably the most, he was probably the most sort of highest level of celebrity that I'd worked with as a director up to that point. And then sort of after him, it was like nothing has fazed me.
Was it weird, though, working with him?
Like, of course it was. I mean, especially the first, you know, the first day, and then it was. It was and then it wasn't. It was almost like the thing about working that show was the beginning of the day was so surreal. The beginning of the day one, you know, was so surreal to be on that set and, you know, that you'd lived as I'd lived as an as an audience member, you know, but to actually be on the other side of the looking glass. I felt like it was Alice, like going through the looking glass.
Yeah, yeah.
And here I am, you know, and you see all of the people and they're perfect, like the way they look and the way they're dressed. And then just outside of the frame are like 35 people who were dressed in hoodies and holding boom mics and stuff. And you're
eating
just like,
donuts.
This is so weird. And eating donuts. And then the even weirder thing, the even more sort of surreal and through the looking glass thing was that by the end of the day, it was so completely normal. Like, it was just totally unfazed. You know, I was not fazed at all. So, yeah, even though it was my first time working on the soundstage, working in L.A., working with a big union crew, like, the whole thing was a new experience for me. It just so quickly became easy and normal and normalized, you know, and working with all of these actors who I had admired so much. And they were just because they're professionals. And John was like, you know, listened to my notes and took them. And everybody else, he was number one on the call sheet. So everybody else like gave me respect because he did. And it was like, oh, this is fine. This is just a job, you know. But anyway, yeah. So and that's what it is. As soon as I've also lucked out that I haven't. I know that some people have probably been warped by their celebrity. Mm-hmm. How could you not? You know,
it's a
weird kind of
place.
Amazing. Like Keira Knightley is probably the person I've worked with who has been the most famous in the world. Mm-hmm. And I remember my assistant, I had a wonderful gal who was stepping up as my assistant on that shoot. And she said after like the third day on set, she said, Keira is so normal. She's more normal than most normal people, which is such a great quote. And it's really true. She was ridiculously grounded, like just totally, you know, she was just very very healthy boundaries. She wasn't like, you know, I don't know, but she was just not at all a diva, you know? And so, yeah, it's been really, I feel really blessed because the famous people that I've worked, people who do have a level of fame or not, haven't been babies or just they haven't wanted to just
none
fuck
those,
with you.
Yeah,
to fuck
stereotypical
with you
stories that people hear
in their trailer or whatever. Yeah. Like none of that stuff, you know? So, and the closest I've come to people being like, oh, if they have a reputation as being difficult, I'm like, what are you talking about? And sometimes it's been because I realized later, oh, it's because they actually care and they have a brain and they want to discuss, you know, they want to talk to you about the scene or this, or they don't understand and they want to get to the bottom of it. And sometimes it gets heated because you're like passionate about the work.
Yeah.
And then, a producer will come up to me afterwards and go, what is everything? Are they okay? Are they angry? Or are you okay? Or I'm like, oh, yeah. We were just talking about the scene, you know, and then later I'm like, oh, that must be why they have this reputation for being difficult. Because it's like, oh, really? Is that it? You know, because I love that.
Yeah, that's just the exchange of ideas, art,
God,
you know.
Exactly. And I have to say that one of the things I'd forgotten about in rewatching Code 46 was I thought the music was just a huge element in that in that film. The Free Association was the score. They got the credit. I don't know if who they are. Are they one person or are they a couple people or a band?
I don't know. I'm not really sure. I was going to look it up.
So evocative.
It's one of those things where when I was watching it at first, you know, I was much more taken by the visuals. But then when I let in another sense, I was like, oh, okay, I see now.
It's really a combination. Yeah. And the visuals, yeah. I mean, the DP, and there were two credited.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how many. You know, how much screen time, if it was half and half or if one of them did the majority of it or what. But the camera work was just incredible. It was just so stunning, I thought. It was, again, very much when you do that kind of a lot of handheld and when you do that kind of it's like you're all dancing together. It's like the camera becomes one of the characters and you have to sort of be so tuned in. The camera operator has to be so tuned into what's happening with the with the actors. And sort of knowing exactly when to pull away to, you know, hands or, you know, from one face to the other or, you know.
Yes.
One of the loves there is, I'm giving it away, but I'm sure spoiler, but there's a love scene in my film that is one of the probably one of the scenes in my career that I'm most proud of directing. I love it so much. And somebody asked me, did you hold the camera? And I was like, oh, God, no. But I was right there with him and he did it. Nate Miller, my beautiful director of photography, he performed it exactly how I envisioned it, you know. And but he had to feel it's like he's almost acting the scene with them.
Yes.
And he had to feel exactly when to pull away to their face and up to the back and exactly how to frame each. I don't know how to explain. It's really a magical thing when you find somebody who's capable of that because it is not easy and they make it look easy. It's like good acting. You know, actors who are so incredible, they make it look like it's just nothing, you know, and that's very similar to that kind of camera work.
The one thing I'm going to leave us with today is I had actually rented this DVD for Code 46 from my local video store. Shout out to Videotech in South Pasadena. And I was, you know, really happy to see that there was a special features menu. But one of the special features, I don't know if you saw this on, on your DVD copy, but one of the special features is a preview for the film Species 3. Which I thought was the most hilarious matchup. And it made me maybe understand a little bit more about why no one saw
Code this movie.
46.
Because they just bungled the distribution.
I saw
it listed, but now I'll have to go back and watch it.
I
would like to give a shout out to Scarecrow Video in Seattle because they're the ones who gave me the opportunity to watch this DVD.
Thank you, Videotech and Scarecrow.
Yeah.
We really appreciate you guys. Please visit your local video stores. And thank you so much, Lynn,
for coming in.
We wish you all the luck with Outside In. Okay, thank you so much for listening to Switchblade Sisters. Next week, we'll be talking to director Mira Menon. She's directed such films as Farrah Goes Bang and Equity. She's also directed episodes of Glow, Halt and Catch Fire, and Fear the Walking Dead. She'll be on to discuss the Gareth Edwards film, Monsters. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air. Bobo Puppyhead says, April Wolf brings to light so many gems that I wouldn't have heard of otherwise. I'm overjoyed to come out of each episode with the most delightful homework. Great movies to watch. Thanks. Bobo Puppyhead must know that I used to be a teacher. I love giving homework. Cammy Robin says, I was so incredibly grateful when my friend sent me a link to this podcast. It's the podcast I never realized I've been waiting for my whole life. As a female filmmaker in a very male-dominated field, it's so refreshing to hear women sharing stories and insights into the world of movies in such an open, inviting, and interesting way. Thank you so much. We are here for all filmmakers, female or male, but we love inspiring new people to do new things. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. And please check out our Facebook group, facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. This is a production of MaximumFun.org.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.